Hello, and welcome to Wiki Politiki, a show designed to bring right and left front and center, to turn the funk into function, and leave the junk at the junction. At a time when so much political discourse is heat without light, Wiki Politiki shines the light of love and truth on the darkened corridors of power, and then brings leading solutionaries into conversation to light the way forward together. Your host is Steve Behrman, author, comedian, and political and spiritual uncommentator. You might know Steve as his cosmic comic alter ego, Swami Beyondananda, or as the author of a more serious book with cellular biologist Bruce Lipton, Spontaneous Evolution. If you recognize that crisis precipitates evolution, and judging by the current crises, the chances of precipitation are 100%, this show is for you. Welcome to the Evolutionary Uprising. Now, here is your host, Steve Behrman.
Well, hello and welcome to Wiki Politiki, Conversations for Co-Creation, where we shed light on the darkened corridors of power, and we shine light ahead of us to the path where evolution is leading. Purpose of Wiki Politiki is to bring left and right, front and center, to face the music and dance together, to address problems rather than defend positions. You know, sometimes I think we've created the political polarization and paralysis, the toxic culture wars, the fixations on the pedophile elite, and the arguments about how many sexes there are, so that we can distract and divert ourselves from the elephant and donkey in the living room, what scientists are calling the sixth great extinction. The foreboding symptoms include climate chaos that seems to be spiraling out of control, dying oceans, societal unrest, and species loss. And at the top of the endangered species list, by the way, whether we accept it or not, is our own species. And yet, so many of us want to imagine that life is going to go on as usual. Meanwhile, the two sides have retreated to their respective corners and are indulging those two drugs more popular and more dangerous than the opioids, hopium and Dinyatol. We have one force strung out on hopium, hoping that technology will save us. Another addicted to Dinyatol, denying that any problem exists whatsoever. And then, of course, there are those who have been addressing the climate issue for decades and have all but given up. My guest this week on Wiki Politiki, Michael Dowd, offers a way through and past the denial and despair with a powerful reframe he calls post-doom. Writes Michael, there's a quote, "Doom is the midpoint between denial and regeneration, with or without us, and post-doom is what opens up when we remember who we are, accept what is inevitable, honor our grief, and invest in what is pro-future and soul-nourishing." The Reverend Michael Dowd is a best-selling author, eco-theologian, and sustainability activist, whose book, Thank God for Evolution, I love that title and I love the book, was endorsed by six Nobel Prize-winning scientists, by noted skeptics, and by religious leaders across the spectrum. Michael and his science writer, evolutionary educator, and ecocentric activist wife, Connie Barlow, have spoken to some 2,700 groups throughout North America since 2002. Michael's passion and legacy work is most fully expressed in his recent sermons, his 2019 video discussion course, Pro-Future Faith, The Prodigal Species Comes Home, and a new podcast, Post-Doom, Conversations Exploring Overshoot, Grief, Grounding, and Gratitude. Welcome, Michael.
Thanks, Steve. It's a treat to be here with you, brother.
Good. You know, I've always loved the way that you reframe ideas so that people see it from a new and larger perspective. So as a deep background, what is post-doom and how did this idea come about?
Well, post-doom, it's interesting how it came about very quickly was that Connie was writing an email. We were up in Canada. We just did a clergy retreat, and Connie was responding to an author who's writing a book all about assisting trees in migrating, which is her field. And she concluded the email with, you know, she said, we gave these ministers a lot of doom, but, you know, there's only so much doom you can give ministers because they got to go into the pulpit and speak to their congregations. So she said, pretty soon we got to a post-doom place. And, you know, post-doom has a gorgeous sunrise, period. End of the email. And I was like, post-doom? Post-doom has a gorgeous sunrise? That is fabulous. So the next day we actually had scheduled to meet with Paul Beckwith and Paul Chaferka, who are two sort of major leaders in this whole movement of abrupt climate change and, you know, the cascading problems that we're dealing with as a species of our own making. And we ran that idea by them, and they thought, great. So then I started reaching out. I had been sort of pregnant with this idea of having a sort of what I'm now calling post-doom conversation series for about a year. I talked to Carolyn Baker about it probably a year and a half ago. And so then I started reaching out and started calling or emailing, because a lot of these people, you know, I know because we've been traveling on the road for 18 years. And I was stunned, absolutely stunned at the fact that virtually everybody I reached out to said, sure, that sounds great. I'd love to be part of that conversation series. And even a few that initially said, no, I'm too busy. Then when they actually saw who were the other guests and the questions that I wanted to discuss, they were like, yeah, you know, I'd like to have that conversation. So that's how it mushroomed. And now, there's just anybody can learn about it at postdoom.com. But it's what my life in 2020 is going to be focusing on.
Well, you know, I've known you through a number of different incarnations. When we first met, you had I totally adored and appreciated Thank God for Evolution, which we'll talk about this a little bit later, that actually is able to communicate to so many different kinds of belief systems and break through some of the barriers between them. And then you've been, you know, the next level. I think when I interviewed you last year or a bit earlier than that, you were focused on essentially awareness about climate change. And now this post-doom idea. So what was the transition from, fervently working for, to educate and awaken people about climate change to this idea that, are we doomed, and what does that mean?
Yeah, great question, Steve. Just very briefly, Thomas Berry, Joanna Macy, Brian Swim, these were mentors of mine from the late 1980s. But I really lost the ecological heart, the deep green sort of sensibility. Somewhere around 2000, I think I unknowingly got on the bandwagon of perpetual progress and technologically driven perpetual progress. So I started reading several books that were more linear in understanding of history and evolution and more human-centered than Thomas Berry had, for example. And so from 2000 to December 2012, I was very much sort of in this technology, and you know, my worldview was basically from the caves to now to the stars. I believe that humanity was the cutting edge of evolution, and human consciousness was what it was all about, and sort of onward, upward. And then December 3rd of 2012, Connie and I both watched David Roberts' TEDx talk called "Climate Change Is Simple." There's a remix that adds music. Ryan Cooper added music, and it was just so fabulous. I cried. I woke Connie up. We both watched it together. We both cried that afternoon. I bought a half a dozen books, you know, James Hansen's Storms of My Grandchildren, Bill McKibben's Earth, Al Gore's The Future, several others, Paul Gilding's The Great Disruption. And I got the urgency of climate change immediately, and then started studying the rise and fall of civilizations. John Michael Greer became a significant colleague and mentor, read like 14 of his books, and Richard Heinrich and a whole bunch of others. And basically, my worldview shifted radically from 2013 on, and then especially in 2015 when I read in January 2015 William Catton's classic book, Overshoot, The Ecological Basis of Revolutionary Change, which Connie and I both hold as the single most important book we've ever read. It all crystallized. So now I recognize that we're dealing with a predicament, not a problem. We can't solve it with technology. It turns out human ingenuity, technology, and the market are precisely what has caused the problem. They will be the last things that can get us out of it. And I also started studying the fact that the first 97% to 99% of human history, we lived more or less sustainably. That is, we lived in place without destroying the place. We were able to live in a pro-future way, in a way that was a blessing to the future. And that's the opposite of anthropocentrism or anthropocentric or human-centered cultures, and especially industrialism. So now I see that I think that we probably have well, who knows how long we have. You know, we'll either go extinct in the next, 50 years, or we may last. There may be remnant populations of us that last another 2 or 3 million years before an asteroid or supervolcano takes us out. But the fact that we are already living in abrupt climate change, which means like 10,000 years of climate change in one human lifetime, means that there's a decent chance that our species will not survive the next 50 years, and many others too. And so then how do we deal with that emotionally? How do we deal with that spiritually? How do we wake up each day inspired to be alive and to do what we can, where we can, to make a difference however we can, and to have lives of compassion and generosity and service? So that's what this whole post-doom series is about, people who get climate, who get resource depletion, who get overshoot, all that kind of stuff, and then have done the stages of grief work and then come through to the other side of finding the gifts. And that's really what my focus is on these days.
You've interviewed so many people for this, and I'm sure part of that is to rehearten yourself, right, and find out how little nuances of how other people are dealing with it. And what have you found in your interviews? What kind of surprising things, or maybe not surprising things, have you found from these people? You've probably interviewed people who have been mentors of yours, and certainly colleagues.
Yes. Well, yeah, I've had a wonderful conversation with Joanna Macy, who's been a major mentor of mine. And yeah, lots of friends and colleagues. You know, one of the things I'm amazed by is that there is no one way to inspiration. People find a lot of different paths into what I'm calling this post-doom space of gratitude, of love, of life. It's kind of like, you know, I'm speaking to you, Steve, from where I was 10 years ago when I was diagnosed with cancer. I had a tumor the size of my fist in my spleen, and there was a period of about 3 or 4 weeks where I thought I could die in the next 8 months until the chemo took effect. And thankfully, by the grace of life, I was given the gift of the peace that passes understanding. I was genuinely at peace with the fact that I could die real soon. And I've not lost that. And now I've just expanded that to our species, because of course I'm going to die, you know, and of course we're going to die. Of course our species, no species lasts forever. So the sooner that we can get our hearts and our heads around the inevitability of extinction, again, whether that's 10 years from now or 5 million years, it's going to be probably in that window. The sooner we can get to that place, and this is one of the things that I've been amazed, is lots of different people using different spiritual tools and different paths have gotten to that post-doom realm of remembering who we are, that we are the universe becoming conscious of itself. We're not separate from nature. We're not separate from life. We're not separate from God or the goddess, to use mythic language, that we can accept what's inevitable, that death is inevitable, extinction's inevitable, and that life will continue, species will continue, the earth will continue, everything, all that's going to continue. And then really focus on, it's important to honor our grief, because we're humans, we're mammals, we're primates, we're going to feel that grief, especially because we're aware of so many other species that are suffering, but then ultimately come to that place of investing our time and energy in what is pro-future and what is soul-nourishing. And there's just a lot there. So these post-doom conversations are so inspiring. Many times I've had a conversation and I get off the phone or get off Zoom where I've had a conversation with somebody, and all I say to, I just go to Connie and I'm slack-jawed, and it's like, damn, that was amazing.
isn't that interesting? When people are really willing to face the music and face the truth, then there are resources that emerge. And, you know, we've lived in such a bubble in our lifetimes, you know, in the bubble of what we would call prosperity, in the bubble of an ever-expanding progress and future. I know a couple of years ago you gave a really wonderful sermon on the end of progress. Tell us a little bit more about that and how your switch got flipped and how that came about.
Yeah, thanks. I don't get a chance to share this that often. You know, the death of the religion of progress, the death of the religion of perpetual progress, which, you know, if you grew up in the Western world, if you grew up in the industrial world in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, even into the 80s, you were, you know, the unspoken kind of the water that we swim in was this unspoken assumption of perpetual progress. And then at some point in time, most of us wake up to the environmental predicament and then, you know, peak oil and climate change and an abrupt climate change and all the rest of it. And the death of a worldview can be crushing. The death of a worldview can be depressing. And the stages of grief are something that very few people get to avoid. Sometimes we spiral into several times. I mean, I've been in recovery for 30 years, and yet I lost sobriety seriously last summer in such a way that essentially I hid my drinking for several nights, and then I didn't show up for a Tuesday evening program that I was supposed to deliver at a church. So there was this professional humiliation, which is exactly what I needed. And so I – recognizing that human-centered progress – that doesn't benefit the body of life, that is everything that we depend upon. If it's not progressing, if it's not becoming more healthy, then human-centered progress is short-term at best. And that's the key piece that is so vital to understand. There is no such thing as human progress that isn't a blessing to the soil, the forest, the water, the life, the other animals, the other trees. I mean, basically everything we depend upon, if we don't treat that as primary, if we treat everything we depend upon as merely its to be exploited for our benefit rather than vows to be honored and respected and be humble before, then we are guaranteed to self-destruct. Every self-destructive culture, every unsustainable culture has been anthropocentric, human-centered. Sustainable cultures are life-centered, ecocentric.
Yep, and, you know, of course, when we adopted the Iroquois Nation's governance system, our founding fathers and so on adopted it. They failed to adopt the Council of Grandmothers. They failed to adopt the idea that there's seven generations ahead and seven generations behind that need to be honored. We're going to take a little break here. We'll be back very shortly with Michael Dowd. We're going to be talking about the post-doom society. This is Steve Behrman on WikiPolitiki.
Connecting you with the best of the conscious minds in the world. Om Times Radio. IOM FM. Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Om Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
Are you done with the daily barrage of negativity? Ready for some positivity? Creations Magazine has been inspiring the soul for over 30 years, delivering thought-provoking and solution-driven articles, essays, and poetry that inspire you to enjoy a vibrant life. Holistic health, personal and spiritual growth, relationships, the environment, and so much more. Read us online or order a subscription, creationsmagazine.com.
911, what is your emergency?
My kid shot himself.
All right, where's the wounds?
911, what's your emergency?
Please help. My son shot his brother.
911, what is your emergency?
Okay. 911, please state your emergency.
Every day, 8 kids and teens are unintentionally killed or injured by loaded and unlocked guns.
It wasn't locked.
It wasn't locked.
Learn how to make your home safer at endfamilyfire.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and End Family Fire.
Well, hi, Beck. We're back with Michael Dowd on WikiPolitiki. This is Steve Behrman. You know, Michael, I always love to find out how people find their calling and how these things develop over time. I've always been, since I read Thank God for Evolution, which I was totally delightful reframe. How did you tell me a little bit about how your spiritual development took place? Did you grow up in a religious household, and how did you decide on the ministry, and how did all of that evolve? Are we there?
Sorry about that. I had you on mute by because I was coughing. Sorry.
Okay.
So yeah, well, I heard the question. Yeah.
Okay. Good.
So yeah, I grew up Roman Catholic. And I was the eldest son of an Irish Catholic family, so I was expected to be a priest. But my parents divorced when I was 12 and didn't go to church a whole lot after that. But I struggled in my teenage years with drug and alcohol stuff, and then joined the Army, went to Berlin, Germany in 1978, and spent 3 years in Berlin. And that's where I had a really profound mountaintop experience where I was given a vision of my own death, and sort of that's when I really began to think about legacy, like what's my life about? What am I committed to? What difference am I going to make? And went to church, this Assemblies of God church that this woman that I was interested in invited me to. And so for 3 years, I was involved in Pentecostal Assemblies of God, you know, very conservative, Bible-oriented. I read the Bible straight through twice. I went to church twice a week at least. And basically, that was my world. But it was very anti-evolution, even though my Catholic upbringing was, you know, just sort of assumed or accepted evolution, just interpreted it in a God-honoring way. And then went to Evangel College, which is affiliated with the Assemblies of God in Springfield, Missouri, and double majored in religious studies and philosophy, got married there. My oldest daughter, who's now 36, was born there. And then went to Eastern Baptist Theological Seminary in Philadelphia, now called Palmer Seminary, which is kind of liberal Baptist. They're sort of like the United Church of Christ. They're not anything like Southern Baptist. Actually, the two split in a civil war. And then pastored three churches, one in western Massachusetts, one in southeast Ohio, and then one in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And during that time, I had really begun to embrace ecofeminism and deep ecology and sustainability and, you know, goddess sort of neo-paganism and some Buddhism. I trained with Thich Nhat Hanh in 1994. So I had a very inclusive understanding of spirituality during that time. And Native American spirituality, especially because I had actually built a sweat lodge on one of my parishioners' property that my congregation didn't know about, but I would lead sweat lodges in Granville, Massachusetts, because I was the town parson. I married, buried, and baptized everybody who wanted it. It was really quite an interesting experience. So then I did sustainability work for 5 years. My job was to help neighbors come together and support each other in using less water, driving less, composting, recycling, basically all the different aspects of living a more earth-friendly, creation care, sustainable lifestyle. I did that from 96 to 2000 in Portland, Oregon, and then in New York, Rockland County, New York. It was called the Portland Sustainable Lifestyle Campaign. Amazing program, wonderful program, because it helped people change their habits, but also build community with their neighbors. It was incredible. And then met Connie Barlow in 2000. I'd learned of her 3 years earlier through her writings. She wrote a book called Green Space, Green Time, The Way of Science, which is really the spirituality of science, which is one of the leading books in religious naturalism. And we fell in love as mission partners. And then, in fact, we celebrate the 19th anniversary of our declaring ourselves mission partners here on December 29th. And when we had this vision of living on the road, and we've been doing that now for 18 years. So the vast majority of our marriage, we've lived traveling North America, speaking in churches, colleges, universities, and what have you, occasionally a synagogue. And essentially where science, inspiration, and sustainability intersect is what our passion is. And then, as I mentioned before, the climate and deep sustainability and deep adaptation and has become front and center in the last 7 years. And so we've spoken to about 2,700 groups literally from atheists to evangelicals and everything in between. And I love living in people's homes, because we couldn't do this if it weren't for people who have surplus housing, who invite us to stay in their second home or vacation home for, you know, a few weeks or a month or sometimes 2 or 3 months. And so that's where I'm speaking to you now, Whidbey Island in the Pacific Northwest, where about every 3 years we spend 4 months in the mother-in-law wing of this house of these people who've become like extended family.
I love your you also have a Sprinter that you travel in, and I love the symbolic gesture of the two fish, the Darwin fish and the Jesus fish kissing. That would come with
kissing
about that
with hard between the, yeah. Although that van, we had that van for 14 years. And then it died, and now we have another Sprinter, but it doesn't have the Jesus and Darwin fish kissing with hearts between them. And I'm kind of glad for that, because that was like a billboard. I mean, everywhere I would go, I couldn't pull into a rest stop or a gas station without somebody either giving me a frown or a thumbs up or like coming over like, what's that all about kind of thing. So I like not having a billboard on my back now.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. Yeah, that gets old after a while, having the same conversation. Yeah. You know, but again, it certainly struck me. The other thing that struck me about your presentation is that you've given the exact same presentation for scientists, for religious people, for spiritual, not religious, for integral folks, and they all have the same response. It's so unusual because people are in their silos. How have you managed to communicate the same words? You're using the same words for all of these audiences, and have it land. How did that come about?
Wow, what a great question! I've never asked that. That's awesome. It came about quite naturally, but quite deliberately as well, because there was a period of about 3 years where Connie and I actually handed out feedback forms and invited people to be brutally honest with us, like where does this work for you, where does it not work for you, and I would tell people, feel free to be anonymous. I don't need to know who you are. I just need your radically honest feedback on the language I'm using, the concepts I'm using. You know, basically, at any level, if you can help me improve, I welcome that. And I got lots of great feedback from lots of different audiences. So I just basically honed my language and message so that now I can be in exactly the same setting. In fact, as you mentioned, one of the stories I enjoy telling is that, like 10 years ago, I did a program at the United Nations called, it was sponsored by the, I didn't get a chance to speak to the whole United Nations, but it was sponsored by the Values Caucus there. And I delivered a program, a keynote, like a PowerPoint slide program with lots of gorgeous slides. And it was titled Evolution and the Global Integrity Crisis. And Michael Shermer at Skeptic Magazine, who's a friend and colleague, and I sent him the link to the audio, and he said, wow, I'd love to have you deliver that exact same talk to a group of 350 humanists and atheists at Caltech for part of my distinguished lecture series there. So I was like, okay, cool. So I did the exact same program, didn't change a single slide. And then the very next week, 7 days later, I delivered that same exact program at Michael Beckwith's Agape Spiritual Life Center, which is sort of a new thought mecca. And then a month after that at a Catholic church, and then 2 weeks after that at an evangelical church. And of course, evangelicals, atheists, New Agers, and the United Nations and Catholics, those are five totally different populations, and yet the same exact program worked. And I think it's because what we focus on is what I call the sacred side of science, the inspiring side of a deeply evidential worldview. And I interpret mythic language, when I use mythic language, which I freely do, I interpret it in a this world undeniably real way. So it's inarguable. So even when I have a room full of atheists and humanists, they're hearing stuff they've never heard before. They've never heard people use language of reverence, language of inspiration, in the way that I do, because it's grounded in our best evidential understanding of reality.
You know, I think you've brought something up that's really very key. The piece that I'm working on right now and talking about our current political, the new word, situation, is if we want to heal the cancer on the body politic, we have to first face the heart disease. And the heart disease is the missing sacred at the center. We have different definitions of sacred, but somehow you're able to have this concept of sacred that's so universal, that's so obvious, have that land with all of these different audiences. So what is the core of that sacred that you've been talking about?
Well, sacred means more important than you, more important than us. It can't be bought or sold. And so it's one of the reasons why when you look at the history of civilizations, the history of humanity, okay, the history of humanity in a nutshell is only well known. You can't understand human history unless you have the history of the earth and the history of the universe. And in that larger context, that larger sacred story of 14 billion years of grace unfolding, then you recognize it's not all about us. We're not the center of the universe. We're going to be gone soon. On a cosmic timeline, we're going to be gone at the most in another week. A week is 12 million years on a cosmic century timeline. No mammal our size lasts more than 4 or 5 million years. So, you know, within the next half week, we're going to be gone. And then life will continue. And so understanding that, you look at human history, which is the last day, like the last, you know, December 31st of the 99th year is when human beings, Homo sapiens, Homo habilis would have been, you know, around Christmas Day, December 25th of the 99th year, Homo directus, December 29th. And the last day is Homo sapiens. But 95% of the last day from like midnight on December 30th until 11:20 p.m. on December 31st, we lived more or less sustainably. We lived in a mutually enhancing relationship with primary reality, meaning we related to primary reality as primary, as more important than us. And we measured well-being in terms of how well the soil was doing year by year, decade by decade, how well the forests are doing decade by decade, what are the other species doing decade by decade. And those ecocentric or life-centered measures of well-being. Then we start seeing human-centeredness and anthropocentrism, and that begins to creep in with a certain what Daniel Quinn calls totalitarian agriculture, where it's all about us. We don't care about any other species. And then writing really exacerbates that consciousness shift to a detrimental, self-destructive form of consciousness, where we start thinking of ourselves as better than everything else, and nothing else matters. It's all about us. And now we're reaping the inevitable consequences of that. And so the real challenge for progressives and activists is to recognize that we are the inheritors of systems of anthropocentrism, systems of human-centered governance, human-centered economics, human-centered politics, human-centered religion for thousands of years, not just hundreds of years, not just decades, and that we are in the inevitable contracting ending chapters. And so industrial civilization is no different than the other 115 civilizations that we know of. It's self-destructive because it's human-centered, because it measures well-being in human-centered terms. So it will go extinct, no question. So accepting that we're not going to transform the political realm, we're not going to transform the economic realm, that these are now larger than any human being or any group of human beings, is a really soul-challenging place to get to. And yet genuine peace, real joy, comes when we accept our mortality and we can look reality, and you know that I use the word God and reality interchangeably, when we can look reality square in the eyes and say, thou art more important, and I'm going to listen to you now, including the reality that our days are likely numbered, and that we can still have joyous, fulfilling, meaningful, on-purpose lives, but it's in the context of a contracting society, a collapsing ecosystem, a collapsing biosphere, which is a predicament that we have to adapt to and live with and ultimately die with. It's not a problem that can be solved.
So say more about the distinction between predicament and problem. And also talk about overshoot, which I think is what you termed the real issue as opposed to climate chaos and so on.
Yes. Wow. Thank you. Yes. Overshoot is the cause. Well, anthropocentrism, human-centeredness, is ultimately the cause of overshoot in most cases.
Right.
But overshoot is the cause. Climate change, resource depletion, overpopulation, species extinction, ocean acidification, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, are symptoms of overshoot. And so here's a classic. This is actually from William Catton's Overshoot. He calls the fundamental predicament, the unfathomed, it's not recognized, but it's the fundamental predicament of humankind. and it's related to overshoot, that Europe had achieved population pressure. Europe was actually already in overshoot. The trees were being wiped out. The soil was being lost, as happened in all these other unsustainable cultures and or unsustainable civilizations. And Europe was actually suffering as a result of that. And then an entire new hemisphere was, quote unquote, discovered. Now, it was fully inhabited by the indigenous people here who largely, not entirely, but largely lived in a pro-future way. And they were 90% of them were wiped out by our germs before most Europeans had to interact with them. So it appeared to be, from the European perspective, an uninhabited continent, full of resources of every kind, trees that hadn't been seen in 1800 years in Europe, the size of these incredible trees, animals, food of every possible kind. And then when coal, oil, and natural gas were discovered, we were abundantly rich in all that. So the mindset and the expectations were, A, you could keep moving west. You could destroy the soil and the land and the trees, but you could keep moving west. So there was always new resources. So there was that sense of that frontier mentality. But there was also the sense of limitlessness, that anything was possible. If you just threw enough human ingenuity and enough energy at something, everything was possible. So we shipped that mindset all over the world. So the people in India and China and Bangladesh and European Union and everybody else expects to be able to live like middle-class Americans, and that's what they're being sold. And yet we are actually living in a world not as it was in America during those days of carrying capacity. That's the ecological term, carrying capacity surplus, more than enough. We're actually living in a world of carrying capacity deficit. Yet we have the mindset and expectations that still reflect carrying capacity surplus. And that mismatch is not a problem that can be fixed. It's a predicament that we have to adapt to and live with. And ultimately, it will probably destroy us if abrupt climate change wigs out even worse than it's already wigging out.
Well, you know, that's really, in a way, that's really sobering and, of course, liberating, because in a certain regard, it it liberates us from the kinds of changes that we've imagined will make a difference. And we're going to take a little break. And when we come back with Michael Dowd, we're going to talk about how this new view has impacted his own life and how perhaps the lives of others will be impacted as well. This is Steve Behrman. We're on WikiPolitiki. Back after these messages.
Free your mind with Om Times Radio, IOM FM.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
The student asks the teacher, "How do I experience transformation?" The teacher replies, "When the student is ready to receive deeper answers, the student then asks, 'How do I know what deeper questions to ask?' And the teacher replies, 'When the student decides to commit to a practice inviting transformation, level 2 questions will be revealed.'" Hi, I'm Tomas Garza, and as a teacher and host, I'm inviting listeners to enroll in the Mastery of Transformation by joining me on Decide to Transform, your bridge to Level 2 Answers, Tuesdays, 1 p.m. Eastern, on Om Times Radio.
Imagine being fired because of who you love. Imagine being denied medical treatment because of who you marry. Imagine being evicted because of who you are. Millions of Americans don't have to imagine this. They have to live it. Because in 31 states, it's legal to discriminate against LGBT people. Get the facts at beyondido.org. Brought to you by the Gill Foundation and the Ad Council.
Well, this is Steve Behrman. We're back with our guest, Michael Dowd, talking about post-doom. You know, there's something that is so rich and liberating about this in the sadness and the surrender. How has this post-doom view influenced your life on a daily basis? You said you have the honesty to talk about relapse from sobriety. Is this part of what you've had to go through in dealing with the grief?
Yeah, great question. I would say the thing that it's done more than anything else is precisely what the cancer did for me 10 years ago, which was I became much more heightened in my awareness and my deep appreciation for the past and deep trust in the future, including a future without me, but a heightened awareness of the sacredness, the preciousness, the divinity of each moment and every creature and every, all the living beings on the land where I happen to be right now. Not just Gaia or the biosphere in some large sense, that too, but, with every breath, I'm breathing atoms that were created in the past and they nourish me. And then with every out breath, I breathe out atoms that will nourish and be part of other creatures in the future. And so I became 10 years ago stunningly aware of life and the fragility and the impermanence of life. And I accepted that fully, and I didn't resist that, again, by the grace of life. And then I haven't lost that for the most part. And so I've now just applied that to this post-doom. And it is challenging because most people who listen to this radio network, most people who follow you and the other teachers that are featured here are people who are really offering profound tools and practices and exercises and ways of being inspired and focusing on the positive and whatever. And that stuff's going to be needed more than ever because, most of us kind of thought and we're hoping and working towards transforming the systems, transforming the world, transforming consciousness, like at a large scale, billions of people. And it is sobering. It is, or in my case last year, unsobering, but it's depressing at times. I mean, the stages of grief, grieving, this is what Joanna Macy's work is so great about.
Yeah.
When you grieve, you wouldn't be grieving if you didn't love. Grief is a measure of our love, and it's a measure of our profound interconnectedness and interrelatedness with life. And so on a day-by-day basis, I'm really present to my mortality, to our mortality, to the fact that we're living in times where every season is going to be more challenging than the previous season because the jet stream's wigging out and we could see major famine in the next few years because all it takes is two or more of the major food-growing regions of the world, there's only like six of them, to fail in the same year that you've got famine. And if you get three or more that fail in the same year, you got massive famine. And that's not at all outside the realm of possibility because we're so dependent upon industrial systems with long supply chains and everything else. So breathing with all that, appreciating life on a day-by-day basis, week-by-week basis, finding something that you can do that can be a blessing to your community, that can nourish your relationships, your friendships, your family. This is the time to improve, to repair, to reconcile, to grow more deeply in relationship, not just with the other humans, with the other beings in your neighborhood, your region, but doing so from not a place of giving up. It's the opposite of giving up. You're more engaged in your activism, if you're an activist, than ever before. But you're doing so not from a place of fear. You're doing so – and not from the place of this urgency of like, enough of us need to do this in order to transform the systems, because you recognize the systems aren't going to transform before they hit the wall. Industrial civilization is going off the cliff, and it may take all of us. We may all die, but it's at least going to – trim the human population down probably to 5 to 10% of what it is now within the next 50 to 100 years. And that's unstoppable. So how do you be with that from a place of generosity and deep-hearted gratitude for what has been and the grace of being able to be alive at this time? And, I live with joy. I live occasionally. I dip in, I don't expose myself to the quote unquote news a whole lot because it's just crazy making. President Trump is not the problem. He's a symptom of the problem. I mean, sure, would Bernie Sanders be a heck of a lot better? Of course. And Elizabeth Warren or a lot of others. But the truth of the matter is the powerful elite have been in control of this government for so long, and they're fighting amongst each other, so there's not some small group that's ahead of the whole thing. And the fact of the matter is, this is what happens in every, or virtually every, collapsing civilization. We see this senility of the elites, the power becomes less and less, concentrated in fewer power and fewer hands. The middle class washes out, the poor class grows exponentially until finally it's, you know, the elite end up as lamppost decorations. And we're going to see that too here. And so finding that place of heart and joy and making a difference where you can and being an activist in your local community and just living life fully and loving the life you live with a heart of unattachment and a heart of gratitude and trust. This doesn't get any better. And I think we're privileged to know what we know, even though it can be very sobering.
You know, it's really interesting. This is really, in a certain regard, the purpose of death. You know, we've been a death-denying so-called civilization. And if you look at where all the money is spent in the medical industry, it's in the last stages of life.
Exactly.
Trying to somehow preserve this physical shell and resisting life itself. And so what you're suggesting, I mean, if every human being, of course, you went through your own personal near-death crisis with your cancer. And from there, it's recognizing the preciousness of every day and the aliveness that comes from that. And there's so many people who are, walking dead. We've had a zombification of so many things in our civilization and people choosing virtual reality because it seems more livable than reality.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
What you're offering is a way for people to be present in the moment, which is all there is, rather than be enslaved to the idea of personal betterment. And you know, here you're talking about the perfect storm and the perfect arc of here are all of these what's in the personal growth movement. There's also been this meme and myth of perpetual growth and expansion and the age of Aquarius and all of this happening, and for people to really turn a corner with that. I mean, what have you found in addressing people who've really been bought into this idea that the individual growth, individual expansion, success, et cetera, what have you found in that?
Yeah. Well, first of all, it's all right on schedule. This is what you see. This hyper-individualism and this focus on the self is precisely what you see in a culture of carrying capacity surplus. The pie is growing. The economy's growing. Possibilities are growing. Opportunities are growing. And that's just normal. And now we're living, it turns out, we're living, of course, in carrying capacity surplus, and things are depleting and getting worse, and species are going extinct, and the climate's getting more unpredictable, and, et cetera, et cetera. And so it turns out that in the previous dozens and dozens of civilizations that have collapsed, the most difficult time to be alive is when you're born into times of expanding possibilities, and then it shifts in your lifetime, and now you're living in contracting possibilities. If you live your whole life, you live and die in expanding times. Progress is not a belief, it's a fact, at least human-centered progress, because you're probably not paying attention to everything we depend upon. And if you're born and you die in contracting times, as those from the 1980s and on have, all you've ever known is contraction. But there's so much denial. So I love your terms. I mean, Steve, you're like the master of a play on language. I love it. I love, love, love it. And I love the way you do that. And hopium and deniatol are just exactly it, because this is the two things that you see in most previous collapsing civilizations. You see some people deny it. It's not, things aren't getting worse. Things are continuing to get better. You saw this in Rome. You saw this in Maya. You saw this in all the previous collapsed civilizations. But you also find people who basically are sort of in this sense of, if all of us can just transform the systems, if we can all just get together and have a consciousness shift or whatever. And that's also unquestionable. There's no doubt that there are going to be lots and lots of people, millions of people, that's going to be. So don't fight that. Accept that. If your friends and neighbors and family are in denial, let them be in denial and just love them the way they are and love them the way they're not. You know, it's like the techno-optimist. I created a Pinker takedown video, sort of a 20-minute or 24-minute, I think it is, called Sane versus Insane Progress. It's up on YouTube. It's for free. But it's you know, you really can see the insanity of trying to describe progress in human-centered ways. And, you know, Steve, there's two resources that I want to mention to anybody listening to this that I only encountered in the last month. One of them is Christopher Ryan. He's the author of the New York Times bestselling book Sex at Dawn, which is all about sort of what sexuality has been like in healthy cultures, sustainable cultures. But this one's called Civilized to Death, The Price of Progress. Brand new book. This came out 2 months ago. Civilized to Death, The Price of Progress by Christopher Ryan. And it is absolutely fabulous. And then a book I just finished recording the audiobook of yesterday, a little book. I mean, literally, I'd read the whole thing in 2.5 hours by John Halstead, H-A-L-S-T-E-A-D, called Another End of the World is Possible. And he speaks with such heart and such generosity about the necessity of celebrating, not just accepting, but celebrating our mortality individually and collectively, and then what kind of end, what kind of life is possible and service is possible when we do that. And so I highly recommend those two books, Another End of the World is Possible and Civilized to Death.
Very, very interesting. And you know, this is really it's kind of like the experience that people I've met who've had, you know, literal near-death experiences. They've gone to the quote-unquote the other side. They've, you know, been through the light passage, and for some reason they get pulled back here. I'm not going to say that these people are in bliss, but they've certainly been liberated from the burdens of fear of mortality.
Exactly.
And the burdens of all of the dances that we do to avoid facing the music. And I really appreciate that you're talking about letting people be and loving them as they are. You know, I had, you know, dinner with a Republican friend, and he says, well, you know, I didn't vote for Trump the first time, but I'm going to vote for him again because things are looking very prosperous. In fact, there are higher employment among black people than ever before and all of that. And, you know, again, we are subject to the mindsets that we have. But you're talking about, you know, as the Swami would say, we don't need homeland security if we have heartland security. And yes, our true security is in the land of the heart. And as we leave these belief systems that people find such comfort in, that are very transparent now, is obviously an apparent trend. In addition to those two books and the few minutes that we have left, and by the way, folks, if you're listening, you go to WikiPolitiki. We have a link on this interview when you listen to it. We have a link to the post-doom work that Michael has been doing. But what else in terms of waking up? Is there an invocation? Is there a prayer? Is there something that typifies this for you that you can share with other people?
Yeah, great question. Well, yes, there is, and it's to practice what the founding fathers of this country, founding fathers and mothers, but mostly they were men, and as you said before, they took some of the great stuff from the Iroquois Confederacy, but what they didn't take, the primary thing they didn't take, was a commitment to the future foremost, like pro-future, like the seventh, acting in the present with the seventh generation and the well-being of the seventh generation in mind, knowing that the seventh generation and all the ones between now and then are going to judge you, and they can be your compassionate guide if you ask them and invite them to guide you. They'll help you live in the present in ways that are a blessing to the future. And living with the seventh generation in mind isn't just a good idea. To do otherwise is evil. And that's why we're now in the systems we are. So what the indigenous peoples of the world, the pro-future cultures, the first peoples, they all had a sense that we belong to the land. Not the land belongs to us. That's a Western understanding. That's an anthropocentric, human-centered understanding. So anything you can do to nurture the consciousness that you belong to Earth, you belong to the land, and what can you do to be a blessing? For example, Connie, my wife, even if our species goes extinct in the next 15 years, her life is all about assisting trees, native plants, native shrubs, trees in migrating faster than any other animal can possibly move their seeds. It turns out that the difference between thousands of plants, let's just say hundreds, okay? The difference between hundreds of plants going extinct in the next 50 to 100 years and hundreds of plants and native trees, including great trees like redwoods, surviving will depend on humans assisting them in migrating north. And that's what evolution's been doing. Every time the glaciers came, everything moved south. So this is, you know, plants have been moving north and south, except now they need to do so rapidly that they can't do it without humans assisting them. So fall in love with the piece of ground that you live on. Fall in love with the ground, the living world, the plants, the animals, the soil in a one block or two block radius from where you live. It doesn't matter, even if you live in a city, you can find living land, you can find trees, you can find whatever, and just love it. Just pretend, it's not about believing, relate to the biosphere, relate to the living earth as if it's God, as a greater thou, not a lesser it. And when you do that, you'll be able to face all kinds of craziness in our system with joy.
Thank you, Michael Dowd, for this truly inspirational and I think life-changing interview. This is Steve Behrman. I'm on WikiPolitiki. We've been talking to Michael Dowd on the post-doom society, and we'll be back with you again next week.